This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Summer movie season is here. Hollywood has a lot of money invested in getting it right. What happens when they get it wrong and audiences walk out? This month, Movies on the Radio, we're asking listeners to share the movies they walked out on. Now, we thought our inbox would be filled with suggestions of poorly written, boring films. Instead, there are a lot of reasons people choose to walk out, from sex and violence to bad singing. Joining us to go over the picks, Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater, and Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laura, Marcia, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
This one, I was a little skeptical because I thought, oh, here's an hour of bad movies. But it turns out there's a lot of reasons not to want to stay for the movie, Laura.
So many reasons. And, you know, for me personally, I tend not to walk out of movies because I do it sort of like preemptively. It's like, if I know I'm going to hate something, why even go?
There you go.
So for me, there are many movies that I might have walked out of, but I just never appeared in the first place.
Well, this show is obviously taking head on something that we're always talking about, even if we don't talk about it explicitly, and that's taste, right? That's the most subjective thing in the world. I mean, some people do not want to, as with Laura, see violence. I mean, they just don't want to see extreme violence. It has to be in a fashion that you can tolerate it. Otherwise, you don't want to be confronted
with
it. Other people, you know, if it's a film that's just incredibly, quotidian subject matter, just boring.
Quotidian, by the way, is a fancy word that means common and everyday.
Thank you for translating for the audience.
Please.
I think our audience knows that.
Never use that word because it's not common enough.
Untrue.
Well, vox populi, vox dei, says I. Go ahead.
But, you know, and sometimes people, you know, I think one of the interesting things to think about, too, is how many times you see a trailer for something and it looks like one thing and then you see the movie and it's something else. So sometimes Hollywood or whatever industry is putting out these movies is to blame because they advertise a film in one way and then they deliver you something.
The old bait and switch. Well, I got a lecture once. When I used to work for the Independent Weekly, and I go to a lot of film screenings, and I got a lecture from another film critic who had come all the way in from Greensboro to see a film I don't even remember, but it was the year that The Hurt Locker came out, and I said, well, I have no intention of seeing that movie, and she said, if you are a serious film person, you are obligated to see that movie. And I said, I'm sorry, I completely disagree with you.
Well, and you know, the other thing is that there's a big difference, I think, between going to a movie theater, buying your ticket, sitting down, and walking out of the theater, and being at home, streaming your video 15 minutes in, skip, change to the next thing. I mean, the act, for those young people out there who primarily watch at home or whatever age you are and primarily watch at home and you turn off something, it is not the same as what it feels like to say, I am not going to sit through the rest of this film.
No, and fascinating, not only the fact that people have many different reasons, but when we put out the word, everybody was dying to tell us. I mean, we probably got a bigger response to this than almost anything we've done. So everybody wanted to tell us exactly, sort of along the lines you're saying, I'm making a statement here. I don't want to just tell you or feel like I don't like it. I'm telling everybody, bad movie.
It's also a peer pressure thing, because if you've gone out with a group of people, you have to take, you know, a survey. Are we staying? Are we leaving? Mm-hmm. So the walking out, you know, takes perhaps a consensus.
And finally, something that came up in my social media feed a few times was like, so did you ask for the refund? Because, you know, there's a point at which if you're 20 minutes in and you're just like, this is terrible, okay, maybe you go and say, well, look, this was not what I thought it was going to be. But if you're 3/4 of the way through before you walk out, do you have the guts to do that?
You know, and I didn't even think of it until this moment, but there was one movie that I asked for a refund.
Which one was it?
It was some movie by the Japanese director, Takai, whatever his name is. But anyway, they were sitting at a bar, and this guy took some chopsticks and just jammed them through someone's eye. And it's like, okay, I'm done. And I walked out and said, okay, I need my money back for this.
And you've never had an olive in your martini again. You know, it doesn't matter how good the movie is either, because this one was nominated for 4 Golden Globes and 4 Oscars, but Jean, not impressed.
Hi, this is Jean. I'm calling from Raleigh. The movie I walked out on was Othello, starring Laurence Olivier. When I was a sophomore at UNC Chapel Hill, probably in the early 70s, they were showing Othello, starring Laurence Olivier, at the Free Flick in the Student Union. So I was a very naive young white girl fresh out of Kinston, and I decided I needed to add some culture, so I went to see it. I thought Shakespeare would do me good. I didn't think that I had the judgment to make any better calls than the directors and casting people did, but I did not like the way they put that movie together. I thought that Laurence Olivier was terribly overacting.
What art thou?
Your wife, my lord, your true and loyal wife.
Come, spare it! Damn myself! Lest being like one of heaven, the devils themselves should fear to seize thee, therefore be double damned. Swear that thou art honest.
Oh, heaven doth truly know it.
Heaven truly knows that thou art false as hell.
To whom, my lord? With whom? How am I false?
I could have put up with that, except, you know, I didn't really know who Laurence Olivier was, and when I saw that if you looked down his collar, you could see he had white skin and he wasn't really black, I said, this is ridiculous. I cannot believe they could not find a black actor to play this role. So I simply walked out.
From the 1965 production of Othello, starring Sir Laurence Olivier and Dame Maggie Smith.
And excellent clip, Frank.
Yes.
Because it looked just as bad as it sounded. I mean, there's Shakespeare kind of has that sound of over the top, but oh no, this was really kind of crazy.
And the whole idea of casting, the racial casting issue, which now we're just so intolerant of people in blackface, you just can't do that. And I've been reading such interesting things about this new version of the Disney Aladdin, where they're trying to have, you know, racially sensitive casting. And some people say this is a great leap forward, and other people say, but isn't it just the same old Orientalist stuff with, you know, another skin tone?
So. Well, this is so interesting, too, because at one point, I mean, Olivier was considered
the
one greatest of the greatest...
the greatest actor in the world!
And so I think it also tells us something about sensibility. I mean, if you think about the mid-1960s and what's happening in the culture, I mean, Olivier seems like he's from another century, practically, when you listen to that clip. And I could see how a college student in particular would go, what is this?
Well,
this
if you're channeling, this is what actors do. They play other people. But if you're channeling Othello, that's one thing. If you're channeling a black actor, and I think that's what you felt when you watched Olivier, then that's when it becomes blackface. And I think that, you know, and again, that's subjective. But this is somebody who is more or less a contemporary watching this, too. It wasn't somebody in 2019 watching this film. Mm-hmm. Fritz the Cat, on the other hand.
Hi, I'm Deborah. I'm from Holly Springs, and the movie I walked out on was Fritz the Cat. It was part of a double hitter with Fritz the Cat Comes Back, so any allusion to Dr. Seuss ought to be dispelled right away. Fritz the Cat was promoted as an art film, something avant-garde. It was back in the 1970s. It it turned out to be an animated porn film involving the cat, who was a little bit too oversexed, and you can just take it in your imagination from there.
Hey, Buzz, how'd it go with a Dee Dee chick, huh? She got some bod, huh? You have to admit. Old Charlene isn't bad either, though, right? Like, wow. Heinz, you swine, old buddy pig. You groove behind Alvina, get some kicks tonight, huh?
Lovely set of eyes there. Four in bed, that's a kick I haven't tried yet.
It wasn't arty. It wasn't fun. It was just stupid. I'd gone over to North Hills with several girlfriends. I was a student at State. I was maybe a freshman, sophomore. So I sat in the lobby and ate popcorn and entertained myself while my friends stayed in the movie. And they did stay for the whole movie and didn't have anything to say about it afterwards.
Fritz the Cat, 1972. First animated feature to be rated X.
Wow, I played at North Hills.
It was a different day and time.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting because this, I mean, I don't know how this film was advertised or how, you know, this listener or anyone would have come to it. But I would think that, like, with R. Crumb attached to it, everyone would have known what you were getting into. But clearly, I think this was the case that, like, when you think, oh, animated film, I mean, it's not going to be that.
Well, even R. Crumb, because this was one of my first dates with my loving wife, who would not be a fan of this kind of film in any way, shape, or form. And I had no idea. I mean, I thought it was just going to be cool, kind of progressive, you know, 60s-ish. No. There was a lot of just real sex.
Yeah.
Animated sex. And it was not comfortable for me or her.
Well, it was part of this sort of underground comics thing.
Yeah.
There was another movie called Heavy Metal that was also animated at this time. And, I mean, people had different standards for this sort of thing.
Marcia, you picked a film that we can't get a clip from, a Pasolini film. Salo?
Salo, or The 120 Days of Sodom. So this is a 1975 Pier Paolo Pasolini film. It's his last film. And I should say, I can watch almost anything.
Yeah.
So unlike Laura, I mean, I do feel...
She has a much higher threshold.
I do. And also, I feel like, okay, and in the case of fiction film, it's not really happening. I know that. In the case of documentary, if it has happened already, I can't do anything to change it but to learn about it. So I have subjected myself to many things. And let me make it clear. Pasolini is a very significant both literary and filmmaking figure. But this is a film that the generic way to describe it is it's about fascism and sadism. But what it's literally about is a group of young people who are kidnapped by these affluent, powerful men and are abused in every way imaginable over the course of what was an excruciatingly long film. And I saw this in a movie theater in New York City maybe 20 years ago. And if I'm not mistaken, I made it about three quarters of the way through when I finally said, I am just done watching this. It was so, and it's deliberately trying to rub our noses in the perverse nature of these fascists.
No,
I
can't
end of World
wait
War II.
To see what shows up in my browser now that I've watched clips
on
YouTube. Yeah, no, it's going to be a new life for me now.
Yeah.
Because Google knows.
And part of it is, you know, I remember thinking like there are young actors having to play these roles too.
I always think these people have mothers.
We'll talk more about them and their mothers on The State of Things, movies you walked out of. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio with Movies on the Radio, talking about movies you walked out on and why. Joining me are two film experts, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyes. Marcia, a film professor at NC State, and Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater. Let's move right on along.
I'm Roy Pine from Hillsboro, North Carolina, and the only movie I've ever walked out on was The Judas Project in 1990. The poster art and previews made it look like a sci-fi film, picturing Jesus arrayed against a couple of Apache helicopters. But when we got into the movie, it was attempting to just tell the gospel story as if there had never been a Jesus. It was laughably bad.
You don't see me as I am. You see me only according to your needs.
Our need, my young friend, is for you to stop this fanaticism.
I've come to help! To bring light into a world that you are destroying and deceiving with your brand of religiosity. The weak need strength. The strong need tenderness. The tempted and fallen need salvation. The righteous need pity for sinners. The fighters need a leader. And the lonely simply need a friend.
There was some disconcerting anti-Semitism in the world leaders arrayed against him all had very Jewish appearance. The one thing I do remember is when we got up to leave, there were people actually booing us on the way out.
There you go.
Wow.
There you go.
Wow.
The film is called The Judas Project from 1990.
Well, just watching the trailer, the acting in it is so terrible. Yeah. And this is a real problem for me.
What a fascinating experience to be booed at when you're leaving a movie theater, because clearly these guys were the only ones there who didn't come for the message. Right.
I mean, I don't know. I didn't see the whole movie. I was just watching the clips thinking to myself, wow, you invested in this. But you see, again, for the audience, if there was somebody who had a kind of a very narrow idea of what Christianity is, you know.
Well, there's a whole subgroup of these kind of Christian movies being made now that have a very specific message
mm-hmm.
That I see the trailers for them, and it's like, you know, this is not for me.
Did the caller say where they saw this? I can't remember. Anyhow, yeah. But I mean, it's interesting to think about where would this have been playing in 1990?
Lots of times religious organizations pay for special showings, too.
Right, like one-offs, and maybe you don't realize that you're going to a one-off.
Well, our next film starred Madonna.
My name's Albert Stagg. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the movie I walked out on was Boxing Helena, 1993. This movie came out, and it seemed like a natural for me to go see. It was directed by David Lynch's daughter. It stars Sherilyn Fenn, who many of us admired in Twin Peaks, of course. You know, it looked to be a quirky, dark, sexy thriller, in that kind of Lynchian manner. And it tried to be all those things. And it's the kind of movie that actually makes you appreciate David Lynch because it's Lynchian without being successfully Lynchian. So it involves a macabre progression of an obsessive, romantic, sexual stalker type.
You're watching me, weren't you?
No!
I'll never need you. I hate you.
It was a packed theater, and that's the other thing I recall was that you had that sense of an audience that was really happy to be there, eager to see this movie, and then just gradually the movie lost the audience, and there were the laughter, and there was the occasional people walking out, and eventually I became one of them.
Boxing Helena, 1993, almost starred Madonna. She is not in this film.
Thank you for that correction. so I have to say that the sense of disappointment you feel when you want a certain movie experience and you don't get it, and it doesn't really matter whether it's a comedy or a crime film or musical or whatever, but like there's a contract you enter into when you put that money over and you go into there and you want that experience, and to feel like, man, they did not hold up their end of the bargain, that's a rotten feeling.
Well, this is a movie where misogyny is repackaged as love. And I have an extremely low tolerance for that, which means about 40% of all movies that have ever been made are off my list.
Well, it's this question of whether or not the representation of the thing, even if the movie is intended to be a critique of that thing, whether the representation is so powerful that you can't get past that.
Well, that's
that.
Just like Solo for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same thing.
Braveheart, on the other hand, was just too long for some people.
This is Rich Holly, and I'm calling from Raleigh. And the movie that I walked out of, along with my wife, was the movie Braveheart. My wife and I have a 30-minute rule for every movie that we go to. We nudge each other and look at each other during that first 30 minutes to make sure that we're either enjoying it or not. And I would say probably in the first 10 minutes we'd nudged each other twice, and I don't think we even lasted a half an hour. And the main reason is because it was just way, way, way too graphic.
It goes on like that for quite some time.
I could listen to that
for hours.
And
once again, I understand that there are special effects and people aren't really getting their heads cut off. But my tolerance for this is extremely low.
Well, and this is a film, too, that it like swept the Oscars.
I know.
Right?
Yeah, what is up with
best
that?
Best director. I mean, those are the especially galling films, especially when you see through them and you're like, no, this is not like Crash. I was the same way that your Crash won all those things. Like, what are people thinking?
What are they seeing?
What are they seeing?
They are seeing Mel Gibson, who's an insider. He's a Hollywood guy, don't you think? Or at least was.
Was.
Ooh. Was. And then. Hey, let's go to the phones here. We've got a call from Fort Bragg and a suggestion for a film that that you walked out on. Nathan, hello. Welcome to the State of Things.
Hi.
Hi, Nathan. Tell us about your film.
It was the second Jurassic Park, which I think was called The Lost World. And I love Spielberg. So, and then I remember the first movie, you know, being great. And then I remember getting there, and as it started going along, it started to just go wrong. It was so predictable. And things like, I think Goldblum had a daughter, and she, you know, she was talking about how she was a gymnastic, you know, person, and she didn't really make it. And of course, later on in the movie, you know, in some beat up barn, suddenly there's a bar there where she can do gymnastics and kick a dinosaur in the face. And then there's these mercenaries, and the mercenaries, you know, they're hardcore mercenaries, but then one of them has to use the restroom. And he hikes a half a mile away from everybody to use the restroom in a place that's full of dinosaurs. And then, you know, they make the T-Rex was everybody's hero kind of at the end. I mean, he was a bad guy in the first one, but then he was a hero at the end. And then in this one, he eats some kid's dog. And I just, you know, I was like, I'm done.
That's it. But this is one where you were disappointed. I mean, the fact is you said you love Spielberg. You saw the first one. You knew what to expect to some degree. And this one just went in a completely different direction for you.
Well, and I think sequels have a totally different kind of pressure on them, right? Because if the first film is so loved, you know, the second one has to at least live up to it being second.
Well, I was reading that the only original summer blockbuster movie this summer is Rocket Man about Elton John, that everything else is either a sequel or a reboot. So there's a huge amount riding on whether people will go to see an original story in the summertime.
Nathan, thank you so much for your call. We are moving on Movies on the Radio.
Hello, this is Sabine Gruffat, and I'm calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And the movie that I walked out of is Dancer in the Dark. And I went to see that movie with a couple friends, and at the time I was a huge Bjork fan, who is this really great pop musician, and she did all of the music for the film, and she was also starring as the lead actress. And I started empathizing with the main character, who is this woman, Selma. She has this horrible disease that makes her go blind. And she's saving all her money to prevent her daughter in the film from going blind also. And then her friend, Bill, steals all her money.
I've seen a man killed by his best friend and lives that were over before they were spent.
The only thing that's important to me, my whole life.
Bjork is this, you know, she almost looks childlike and helpless in the film. And I just couldn't take it. I started crying like I've never cried before. I couldn't see through my eyes anymore. I was crying so much. And it just got to the point where I was so embarrassed about my crying that I had to get out of the theater. And I never walked back in the theater. I just cried and cried and cried. And I was so depressed that I didn't want to go back in.
That's a clip from Dancer in the Dark, starring Bjork, who received a Golden Globe nomination for her performance in that one.
Lars von Trier, the director, he's very cruel to his women characters. And Dancer in the Dark has some really interesting stylistic things going on. I loved watching Bjork, but I totally get why you would not want to subject yourself.
And
to
I mean,
this.
I've taught this film in the context of classes on the musical because it's a very interesting revision of the genre. But I will say this, people who love musicals, I worked once with a curator at the Smithsonian who walked out of this film and said he had never seen anything this atrocious in his life, that it took all the ideas of the musical that were beautiful and just basically like defiled them. And I appreciate that. Yeah. I get that's exactly what Sabine is saying.
Yeah.
Well, is it that, I mean, was that it? Because that's one interesting take. But the other is that it's so effective. It's working too well.
Right.
It's working so powerfully that the emotion that it's up in you is something you can't bear. And so you leave, right? Which is to say it's a very, it means it's a very effective film.
That's right. And if your goal, I guess, is to films often are intend to affect us, scare us, make us feel happy, make us feel sad. But I mean, I think sobbing to the point that you have to leave a theater because you're embarrassed about your emotions is probably taking it to a little bit more to an extreme.
Right.
Then,
well, maybe this is what Hollywood was all about and what we always criticize it for, the Hollywood ending, right? So every time the film would go there, somebody who is invested in this film said, no, you can't leave them like that. They won't come back. Here's how you have to end that film.
Well, von Trier definitely does not provide a Hollywood ending.
I think that's a very mild way of putting it.
All right. Well, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about a movie. We're talking about movies you walked out on. But Laura, you're the film curator, a film curator. You organize many film screenings. And you picked a movie that you watched people walk out on.
Yes. Marcia is in a position where when she shows movies to her students, they probably don't dare walk out of them. Because you watch them walking out and you write in your little ledger.
Yes,
you know.
Demerit.
But for me, you know, I'm trying to provide people pleasure. I want them to enjoy things. And there was one film last year at Marienbad that had so many walkouts. Those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's kind of like the French existentialist version of Groundhog Day. It's very beautiful. You know, Delphine Seyrig wears black Chanel clothes. She wears white Chanel clothes. And I got so many people ragging me after that movie. And I said, I do not apologize. This is part of your cultural education. You can take it or leave it, but I do not apologize.
You are the broccoli lady. You put broccoli on my
plate. I am the broccoli
lady. Laura will not issue refunds
films.
Either.
Diplomaniacs?
Diplomaniacs. So I love sort of the history of comedy and vaudeville. And Diplomaniacs, what came out around the same time Duck Soup did, there were a lot of political movies that came out right when the New Deal came out in the early 1930s. And they're a comedy team that one of my favorite writers, Richard Barrios, says is a taste most people will not wish to acquire.
I see. Well, we have a clip. I'm not sure that you'll be able to determine all of that from this 32-second clip, but let's listen. That's one of the numbers from Diplomaniacs.
Yes, so the way this number starts out, it's kind of a parody of those Maurice Chevalier movies. Yeah. So Wheeler and Woolsey are in bed together, which it was not unusual for male comedians to share a bed. I mean, people did that. But then Burt Wheeler gets up. He puts on a feathered negligee. And when he gets out of bed, Robert Woolsey slaps him on the rear end. Mm-hmm. So it has kind of another meaning. There's also a little sequence where Wheeler reproduces what had been the hit of the 1923 Ziegfeld Follies, where he eats bread, sings and cries at the same time, and the bread sprays out of his mouth.
Frank will be trying that in the final segment,
do
by
that
the way.
Now.
And this movie insults, you know, every possible minority group. I'm not sure that I would show it now because we've been so much more sensitized, but it's a kind of comic anarchy that I really
was it satire on the film
industry? It was a satire
up until that point,
on
which
everything,
is 1933.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you're satirizing a pretty young industry.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. Now, this one is very interesting because this one is a former film projectionist who also had a window on the world. Let's listen.
Hello, my name is Myron. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. I didn't walk out on a particular film, but I was a witness to a spectacular instance. Around 1969, I was projecting, as part of a program, the short The Blood of the Beasts by Georges Franju. And the movie begins with very lyrical, lulling shots of workmen going through Paris in the early hours of dawn. And eventually they all gather in the slaughterhouse where they work as butchers. And as soon as the film began to depict the killing of cows, a fairly large audience bolted for the doors as fast as they could, finding the scenes intolerable, until we had virtually an empty house within the space of less than a minute.
Blood of the Beast, 1949, essentially a documentary.
Yeah, it's such an interesting film. This is one that I have, I have seen, and this is an example for me. I mean, the reality is slaughterhouses function in a certain way. And I mean, as a vegetarian, mm-hmm. I don't have my blood on my hands for that. But I think the fact is that these are things that happen in the world, but people don't want to see them. And people really don't want to see them associated with a city like Paris, where Americans in particular have this ridiculously romantic idea. But they, too, have slaughterhouses, mm-hmm. as it turns out.
I screened for the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, and there is a certain category of filmmaker who uses animal slaughter as a way, I guess, to get your attention. So, I mean, we even like have a category, you know, goat slaughter, pig slaughter, you know, because, you know, they think that, you know, somehow this is going to have us experience reality in a certain way. It's like if you kill a goat in every movie, I mean, what is the point?
Well, that's a quote, by the way. That will go to the grave with you. You know, Laura always used to say, if you kill a goat in every movie, what's the point?
Well, I was just going to make the point, though, that if that's what's happening in the reality of that world, then so be it. And then if that's the context
well,
of the documentary.
Well, part of it is it's very often about Muslims. So it's used as a kind of racist trope. Mm.
I will say in this film, this is one of those films with that for me, and again, it's all subjective. It worked very well. It was effective because a lot of things were happening. The beautiful Paris, the Paris that tourists want to see is you know, sort of projected on the screen. Then we have to go to the back. And what we're looking at is these workers who are fairly impassively smashing the skulls of you know, live animals, and they're bleeding out on the floor. And sort of you have to realize, all right, this guy's making a living. He's feeding his family
That's
with
right.
this. And if you didn't eat that cow, he would make his living some other way. So you ain't going to be judging him, please. And I don't know what you think about Paris, but you, as you said, this has got to be happening behind the scenes. So it was a complex, there was a lot of texture happening. This brutality was happening with these fairly, as I say, impassive faces who are just doing this for a living. A lot going on, and I think in that case, it wasn't just about the gore, and it wasn't about the spectacle. It was, for me, a deep meditation, but you had to put up with the gore.
That's
and that
right.
was the hard part. That
and
was
as,
the hard part.
As you can gather, you can watch this on YouTube if you want to.
You can watch it on YouTube.
It's about 22 minutes long.
And it was hard for me to get the sounds quite right, but they were there. Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Movies You Walked Out On. Coming up, there's more. Stay tuned. Mr. Mina here. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Movies on the Radio, talking about movies you walked out on, movies like Moulin Rouge.
Hi, my name is Andrea, and I'm from Durham, North Carolina. And the movie that I walked out on was a movie I was actually prepared to love and really excited to see. Back in 2001, I saw in the theater Moulin Rouge by Baz Luhrmann. And while I tried to stick with it, I had to leave due to, in my opinion, the really not so great singing of Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor. I am actually a trained opera singer and a professional opera singer. And while it's not about the genres, because I love movie musicals, the idea of the pastiche of songs was great. The opulent sets and costumes and acting were actually all great. But these two leading stars singing really, for me, fell flat and literally was flat.
The duet that not even Melodyne could fix.
Well, had Luhrmann resorted to what so many classical Hollywood musicals did and actually dubbed the voices,
I mean, this is part of the revisionist
better.
Musical that the stars actually have to sing. Don't make them sing. I mean, it's a simple
But isn't that part of the
solution?
Charm? Oh, they're actually singing the roles. That's why
That's what they say. But, I mean, Bollywood musicals never have the person who's acting the role.
Well, and even in just that clip, I mean, what you can tell is that it's so, I'm not a song evaluator, a singing evaluator, but it's so produced. Oh, it's like almost that you can barely get to the voice.
They compress the life out of it, and they have them like nowhere near the top of the song.
But
and then with pitch correction, which is a little squeaky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know other people walked out of this because they got seasick from all the swooping camera movements as well, so it's sort of a double whammy.
Yeah.
All right. Movies on the radio, movies you walked out on. Radio shows you walked out
on. Hi, this is Kelly from Greensboro, and I walked out of Batman, A Dark Knight Rises. I went to see this movie with my husband, and we had not seen a superhero movie in a while. We were a little taken aback by the very large body count. And then also being in the audience with a lot of small children and having a little child behind us saying, Daddy, why are so many people dying, was just a little bit much. I think when we live in an age that's post 9/11, where we're dealing with, you know, trauma and death constantly in the media, to see it reiterated on the screen by our heroes was just a little bit too much for us.
Dark Knight Rises, 2012.
Yes, well, so to bring up Bollywood again, my daughter and I went to see this Bollywood superhero movie in which he did not kill anyone and he allowed the villain to be killed by his own karma. Because as my daughter said on the way home, if both the hero and the villain are murderers, how do you tell them apart? Mm-hmm.
Well, I showed my student Superman in a class that involves superheroes, and nobody had ever seen it before. And they couldn't believe, like, there's not a fight scene until, like, the end of a over 2 hour film. And they were like, what happened? And it's like, well, things have changed with what we expect, you know, being perpetual violence. So I understand that.
20 minutes where I start thinking about what I'm going to be cooking for dinner.
Yeah. I will have to say, I know you've seen a lot of Bollywood films. You have not seen a Rajni film because a lot of people die in those.
Yes, that's
Kabbalah.
True.
In but Kabbalah, people will die in every
second. That's Southern India. That's different.
This is a spokesman for the Modi government, I can tell.
how dare you, Sarah?
Hey, let's go to the phones now. We've got Jennifer on the line from Raleigh who walked out on film. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing fine. What'd you walk out on?
I'm going to tell you that in just a minute. Before I forget, you all are one of my favorite hours of radio, and you are part of why my donation every month makes me happy. So,
sweet.
I really enjoy it.
Very kind.
The movie that I walked out on that I did not enjoy was Stealing Minnesota from 1996, where it had Keanu Reeves and Cameron Diaz in it. And when the movie started, she's basically having to marry somebody to get out of a debt, or she's been given to somebody to clear somebody's debt. I worked in domestic violence and sexual assault prevention at the time, so everything about that was off for me. But everything about the movie just seems terrible. So if my friend and I walked out and I went up to the ticket counter and I said, hey, I'd really like my money back. And he looked at me and goes, oh, you're seeing Stealing Minnesota, aren't you? We can't give people enough money back on that one.
Wow.
Good.
They're
really accommodating, but they also, like, it made me wonder, like, how is it as a theater when you get something that's just such a dud? I have since come back and looked at that, and, like, Rotten Tomatoes gives it, like, a 4.5 or something. But this was 1996, and we didn't have as efficient a way to preview movies in advance, but... Wow. Yes, my most distinct memory is not of the movie, but of the walking out and of the affirmation from the ticket seller of yes.
You were not alone. Jennifer, the film is Feeling Minnesota. Thanks so much, Jennifer, for giving us a call.
Well, and luckily, theaters make very little of their money off of what people pay for tickets. It's all on concessions, so don't feel so bad for the theater. But it's also interesting to think about. Yeah. That's where you vote, right?
Yeah.
Is by giving your money to a movie. And so if it really offends you, it does. It feels... you know, bad. Mm-hmm.
Investors hear that, and then they make different movies.
That's right.
If only.
My name is Allison Cosberg, and the film I walked out on was Goodnight Mommy in 2014, co-directed by Veronica Franz. And I saw it at the New Art in Los Angeles, which is a historic single-screen theater. It shows a lot of really fantastic independent and international cinema. Goodnight Mommy was being promoted as a really vibrant and intelligent and terrifying follow-up to a film I'd really loved called The Babadook that I thought was a really piercing, intelligent portrait of the horrors of motherhood that used horror to unpack taboos around what it means to be a parent in really important ways. And because of that, I also stuffed through quite a lot of the film. I really tried to stay in the theater. I think I walked out about 15 to 20 minutes before its conclusion, which is unusual because you're so close to the end, and yet there was so much violence and torture in the film, I felt that I could not remain in the theater any longer.
Mama?
The violence in the film and the torture that the female protagonist endures at the hands of two male children felt that it wasn't operating to serve a greater narrative function. There was nothing deeper to be learned from the violence. So eventually, it was too much for me. So I had to duck out, and I sat in the lobby where the cast for the evening presentation of the Rocky Horror Picture Show were getting into costume and waiting for my friends to leave.
That's the Austrian horror film Goodnight Mommy from 2014.
Well, I have not seen this film, but I mean, what Allison raises, this is something that touches on what Laura's example is. We trust certain programmers, certain theaters that, you know, not everything is going to be to our taste, but that we're at least not going to see something that is going to...
It's not random.
Exactly. And so I think there is also this sense like, okay, I'm here for this experience, whether it's the best of my life or not. And then when something like this happens, I think you also feel the sense of, man, I really... Yeah. I've got to question my belief in the programmer or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting about this film, the way it worked and the way the horror worked, because I'm listening, you know, I'm listening to what she's saying and I'm going for the clip that's going to illustrate this kind of, this intense horror. The dialogue was so innocent. And so, and that was the juxtaposition of that against the images where everybody's kind of having this, how was your day? I'm doing very well. Thank you. And then the knife slits up through the, you know, the torso. So that all of the images were powerful, graphic, and violent, and the dialogue, you know, was the actual, the backdrop against which all of it happened, which made it more powerful.
These are power trips by the director that I just cannot endorse.
Well, there is a kind of sadism, right, when you have the audience in their seats, and you know, how far can you push them? Some people have limits.
You can trust Tina Fey not to be a sadist.
This is Yvonne Stamm. I'm calling from Carrboro, North Carolina. My pick is Sisters, starring Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, two very talented, funny women. I was not even vaguely amused by two mature women acting like frat boys 15 years their junior. Animal House was very funny, but moving the same kind of stupid hijinks to mature women was not.
Don't you want to feel that carefree again? Just like deep in joy.
Yes!
It's not too late. The young you still lives inside you. Just like shingles, y'all. We used to party in this house like animals because we thought we would never die. I say tonight, we party like Vikings because we know we could die tomorrow. Let's light a boat on fire. Tonight is my gift to you. I'm pouring shots now. Remind me that you know how to do this.
I remember how to do it.
And let's dance on tables.
I call it Arrested Development, but that name's already been taken. I was at a medical office recently and was discussing my reaction to this movie, and the workers there were all saying, oh, yes, wasn't that awful?
Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, the movie was Sisters in 2015.
This is why we need more female movie executives to greenlight better female-centered movies.
Mm. You know, in some ways, I find that comedies are maybe the most disappointing because you go to a comedy because you want to laugh. And when it's not funny, like I recently saw Long Shot, which I know some people have loved. I thought it was atrocious and demeaning and awful and didn't laugh once throughout the entire film. And I was extra mad because I wanted to laugh and I found nothing funny about
it. Well, we used to go to the movies every Tuesday night when Adrian was small. And once we went to see the first Austin Powers movie, which my husband hated so much that he came home, even Adrian as a little girl remembers, in a towering rage and made me drive the babysitter home because he was so mad that he'd wasted his life with that.
Robbed
Nothing makes me madder than a bad comedy.
Hi, my name is Rick. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina, and the movie I walked out on was Ingrid Goes West from a couple of years ago that had Aubrey Plaza and Elizabeth Olsen, and it was about one woman's obsession with an Instagram star or something very similar.
Maybe you're confusing her with one of your Insta fans.
You are by far the coolest, most interesting person I've ever met.
You're so funny. I love you so much. You're amazing.
Thanks. You're the best. I need you to tell everyone you're my boyfriend.
What is this? Why are you acting like this? You don't even like these people.
I do like them.
Is everything okay?
Yeah, everything's dope.
I walked out on it because the pacing of the movie was so boring. There was nothing redeemable about either of the main characters, and basically it became a promotion for pretentiousness, and given how much attention is given to celebrities that have no actual talent, I couldn't stand sitting through another minute of the movie, and so I walked out about halfway through, and the funny thing is, I was the only one in the theater watching the movie.
Should have checked with the critics before Rick went to see that. That was a movie called Ingrid Goes West. Now, which screened at Sundance, right? How was that received?
That was a crazy, predatory females, that fatal attraction nonsense.
Yeah.
It just really... that fear of female sexuality, I just cannot. That's something else I can't endorse.
Didn't see it. Sorry.
Well, you know what Rick said? I would just say this about the pacing. He's right. That actually, the clip came from the trailer. So we got everything nicely compressed. Because if you were watching the film clips themselves, I would lose listeners. So I couldn't do it. Hey, at least one more. Let's do it.
I'm Brandon Fry from Lexington, Kentucky. And I walked out on the movie Waking Life, which was written and directed by Richard Linklater. I saw the movie when it was released in 2001, primarily because I liked Linklater's 1991 film Slacker, a humorously shambolic study of the philosophy of Austin dropouts. Waking Life is essentially an overthought remake of Slacker, in which Linklater tries to philosophize himself rather than document the comically failed efforts of others. The gimmick is that the entire film is rotoscoped, or animated by tracing film images. Think of the video for Aha's Take on Me, for example. I found it insufficiently distracting to mitigate the pompousness of the underlying movie.
It's like you come onto this planet with a crayon box. Now, you may get the 8-pack, you may get the 16-pack, but it's all in what you do with the crayons, the colors, that you're given. And don't worry about drawing within the lines or coloring outside the lines. I say color outside the lines, you know what I mean? Color right off the page. Don't box me in. We're in motion to the ocean. We are not landlocked, I'll tell you that. So where do you want out?
If you liked My Dinner with Andre, you'll love Waking Life. For my part, I prefer Andy Kaufman's My Breakfast with Blassie.
Waking Life was the film, 2001.
I actually love the comparison to My Dinner with Andre because both of these films I can't tolerate either. I find them exhausting and I feel like I went to college already. I don't need to hear this all over again. So I just have no patience for it. I remember sitting through them going, are you kidding me? This is it?
I was a little bit distracted by the animation style because it sort of evolves into different things and...
But. Was that the hope? Do you think we're going to do this warmed over dorm night philosophy, but we're going to have this cool stuff on the screen?
I think it's possible in 2001. I have more patience.
Okay, Laura Boyce, well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the thing is, can you imagine this movie having actually gotten a release without having a gimmick like that?
Right.
Name director,
right? Exactly, well, maybe he would have gotten away with it anyway. But if you notice, I remember when it came out, everyone was talking about the rotoscoping, so it was a kind of distraction. I think that like here's this thing that we've innovated, and now, you know, at least it gives you something to look at.
We've distracted all of you for 1 hour on the radio, and we've done a fine job. Laura Boyce, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I should say the Movie Diva series is screening Skyscraper Souls on Wednesday, June 5th at the Carolina Theater in Durham. And you can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. Next time, movies on the radio, the environment. Films about nature, the natural world, and environment.
I think this is an important one.
It's an important one. And lots of scope.
Fiction, here. Nonfiction. You name it.
It's all going to be there. We'll talk about it next time on Movies on the Radio. Check out our website, stateofthings.org, and that's how to be part of the show. The show is The State of Things. It's produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.